and welcome to Middle Age Geeks, the podcast where we aim to talk about movies, video games, TV shows, comics, and anything else geeky that takes our fancy. My name is Phil, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Daz. Daz, how are you?
I'm very good, my man. Very good indeed. A good week of playing and watching some pretty decent stuff, so happy out. How about yourself?
Yeah, same. I haven't gotten around yet to playing everything I wanted to play, but it's been a decent week. Seen some good movies. I'm looking forward to talking about this movie this week because we haven't spoken about it yet. I know I just texted you when I came out of it. I have this kind of feeling, before we even talk about it, I have a feeling about it that I think this is going to be how Everything Everywhere All at Once was, where you're blown away with the technical marvels because you understand all this stuff. And you're like, wow, what they did there is so impressive. And and I'm blown away by, this is so fucking weird. I love it. Like, just because I love weird shit, you know? And I think that this is both a technical marvel and also a bonkers fucking movie. So I'm looking forward to getting to that. I'll probably still mention now in the intro that it is going to be spoiler heavy for a movie that's just out. We're doing Poor Things that only just came out. So, you know, wait, if you want to listen to the rest of the episode, look at the time codes. Or if you're happy enough to have it spoiled, you know, you can feel free to sit through it and enjoy me and Daz talking about it. But before we get into that, I would be interested to know what's been going on for you this week. What have you been playing and watching?
I have a conundrum in terms of games at the moment. I can't seem to finish any fucking games. So I'm still trying to finish RoboCop. Which I'm loving, but just playing a bit less and less because Last of Us 2 came out, the remaster. So, of course, I started playing that, and about an hour into that, I stopped and I said, like, what the fuck are you doing? You need to go back and finish some of these games. So, at the moment, like, I'm juggling RoboCop, Jedi Survivor, Alan Wake, Cyberpunk, Resident Evil 4, WWE 2023, and I told you last week I started Celeste again, haven't finished that, and I'm always jumping in and out of FIFA. So, like, It actually just got me thinking about back in the day. Remember when we met each other, like in Electronic Boutique and stuff? We'd pretty much be up to date on everything, you know, be it like kind of music, but movies and games. Just like we'd played everything we wanted to play and seen pretty much everything, bar a few old movies. And slowly but surely, like over the last 10 years, the movies is, you know, you see kind of less and less, maybe over the last 5 years, TV's gotten out of control. There's just too much TV that never going to catch up on that ever. But the movie thing definitely got to a point where there's so many movies you have to catch up on. And it does get to that worrying point where you're going, is shit, am I ever going to have enough time to catch up on these movies? And that's kind of no, but games was never thought that would be a worry because, you know, you've always like, it's all the time in the world to play games. You can always find time because it's in your home. Like, you don't have to go anywhere. But then, and it was always, you're waiting for a AAA title that comes out, like Red Dead or Last of Us, and you spend weeks just enveloped in that. But now, juggling all these games and just seeing the roster of games coming up this year, and like some of these games, Alan Wake and Cyberpunk and Resident Evil, like they're 20, 30, 40-hour games where I can't even finish RoboCop. It's supposed to be 8 hours long. And I don't know how I've been playing for 14 hours. I'm just walking around, just doing a load of shit. So, yeah. I've been playing a lot of loads of different type of games and getting nowhere in all of them. How about yourself? Have you been playing anything, watching anything?
My plan was to play the new Prince of Persia game that you have been playing.
That's what I've been playing.
And obviously that came out at the same time as the remaster of Last of Us Part 2. So I said, like, I'll try one on the Last of Us Part 2. Give it a couple hours, and then I'll jump into the other one. And I've just been completely sucked in. I was pouring hours into the Last of Us Part 2 again. You know,
it's hard not to play it, right?
It's not a big enough graphical update that let's say if you were stuck in a position where you have played it before and you don't, you can't get the upgrades, you have to pay full whack. It's not worth that. I don't think that it's not that much improvement, but for the tenor, that is all I had to pay to upgrade. So what I'm miles into it. Like, I'm way into Abby story and everything now. Like, I got really stuck in. I won't touch anything else till that's done. You have to just power through it, get it done. And then I'll move on to Prince of Persia, and then, you know, next week or the second, I'm gonna end up having to try what the fuck is it called? Suicide Squad. It's gonna happen, you know. Just out of curiosity, because of everything that's gone on with it, I am gonna have to try it.
Absolutely.
Apart from that, I'm looking forward to stuff more than I've actually been getting into stuff, if you know what I mean. Like when I look at a couple of trailers for movies that I think might even be out in the States, but not yet here. American Fiction. I'm hoping to go and see that next weekend. Wicked Little Letters as well.
What's that?
Wicked Little Letters. That's out the same weekend, I think, over here as American Fiction. So it's a comedy, and it's Jesse Buckley, Olivia Coleman. It looks absolutely hilarious. I love Jesse Buckley, and the trailer, multiple times throughout the trailer, I was laughing out loud in the cinema. So that's a great sign.
That's always good. Yeah.
So yeah. You know what I actually wanted to ask you? Did you see this fucking madness over this game, Palworld?
Have you heard of that? Something on IGN about it. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't read too much into it. Is it something to do with AI-generated madness or something? Or?
No, I don't know exactly, because I haven't. I just saw that it was like one of the highest ever. I think it's more like an open world Pokemon game with guns or something like that.
Yeah.
But like it's like one of the all-time selling premier games on Steam. And like people are going fucking mad for it. People are then modding Pokemon onto this game, Palworld.
Someone said Nintendo are after him because he modded some Pokemon characters into it. Just got an email or a knock at the door or something. But I thought somebody said it's some AI development behind some aspects of it or something like that, that it's just fucking bananas. It seems to be taking over the world. Like,
it could be. I think, as far as I know, I don't think the investment amount was insane to make it either. I think I read somewhere it was like 6 million or something, which is today's money is not fucking very much. But I would think that would spur is it Game Freak? Is that the makers of Pokemon? Game Freak? I think it would spur them on to give people more of what they want. You know, like this, people have gone mad for this. If this was an actual Pokemon game, people would be going ballistic. If it'd be this high of a seller game. But I don't know. I haven't massively enjoyed the last few Pokemon games. I've played them. I don't really give a shit about Pokemon, but I enjoy the collecting side of it and stuff. Now, I don't get as involved as people who are fucking battling their mates and trading stuff. I mean, I just...
But Pokemon Go was fucking cool when it came out. Just randomers on the street just fucking aiming around.
Yeah, that was good fun.
That was fucking cool. It's a shame that didn't keep going.
But I'll generally just burn through those games and then they get deleted and I would never play them again, you know. But for an open world thing, hopefully that rather than Nintendo or whoever or Game Freak going after these people are going to go, right, well, let's just copy this. Let's just give it basically what this is and put it out in... as an actual Pokemon game and make an absolute fortune.
Yeah.
Touching
on that, this is how fucking mad it is. I completely forgot that I was playing Prince of Persia, the Lost Crown or whatever. Like when that came out, I got it at midnight launch and played it till about 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was just fantastic. And that was a preface to my whole story. I meant to say that when I was playing that, I was like, right, here we go. I know it's 20 hours or 25 hours, but I was loving every fucking aspect of it and thinking, right, I'm just going to finish this game. This is it. This is my Last of Us. This is my Red Dead. Like, I'm going to just blinkers on. Here we go. And then I got to it. It's an excellent Metroidvania-esque 2D kind of hack and slash with the combat's really kind of... it's really engrossing after a while. It really opens after about 2 or 3 hours.
Right.
It starts to kick into gear. But then there's a level where you go down into the depths or something like that and you lose your map. You can't bring up the map anymore. So you're kind of just wandering around trying to find your way out of these sewers without a fucking map. And it's just 3 o'clock in the morning. It's just like, fuck this. And I haven't played it since. It just takes too much. Anything that just takes too much time as a plot device or something to kind of draw out the level a bit more, I just bounce off completely. But I will get back to it. But it's excellent. But that level drove me fucking insane. But
I've no sense of direction either. Like I get lost anywhere. Even on levels, I'm constantly bringing the map up. I'm just terrible sense of direction in real life as well. So that game does sound like a bit of torture, but I have to play it. I mean, it is
brilliant. It's so smooth, and it's there should be more of those games. It's a great way to reignite the franchise. It's gorgeous, and the combat when it does kick in is badass. There's a couple of times when the bosses are really cool, and even when I dumbed it down to a baby mode, it's still challenging enough, you know. But yeah, really good. But
I will get stuck into that if I get the time this weekend. Maybe as soon as I finish this other one. Okay, cool. Look, that's it then for the intro. With all that out of the way, I'm looking forward to having a conversation about this movie because we haven't spoken about it to each other yet, so I don't even know what's going to happen. So, take it away, Daz.
Happy days. Okay, so Poor Things, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, adapted from Alistair Gray's novel of the same name, or to give it its full title, Poor Things, The Strange Memoirs of Archibald MacCandles, which is, I think they should have kept that title. It's fantastic. They will just go over like a brief kind of plot that doesn't really do it justice whatsoever. And then we can kind of get into our thoughts and then dissect it a little bit. And it's kind of cool. We haven't chatted about it. It's one of the first times. So the plot, the movie begins in Victorian London, where we meet Godwin Baxter, played by Willem Dafoe, who's a kind of Frankenstein-esque mad scientist with a grossly disfigured face. Who enlists one of his students, Max MacCandles, played by Rami Youssef, who I had no idea who he was before this, actually. And he enlists him to help study and chart the progress of his dearest new creation, Bella Baxter. And that's played by Emma Stone. And Bella appears to be an adult woman with the mind of a child. And Max begins to care for Bella as her mind develops rapidly, and then a sleazy lawyer enters, Duncan Wedderburn, Mark Ruffalo, who, my God, I love this man. He sweeps Bella off her feet and whisks her away to explore the world and partake in lots and lots of madness and copious amounts of sex, or furious jumping, as Bella so hilariously refers to it. And Bella's journey takes numerous dark and twisted turns as her mind evolves, and she sees the best and worst of the world and society at large. And that's a tiny little, if you read that, you kind of go, okay, yeah, that's what the hell is that? So just your first thoughts on this movie, straight out of the cinema thoughts.
Yeah, I stand by what I texted you when I left the cinema. Because all I did was send you one text message, and that was that it's a masterpiece. I absolutely loved it. I'm still thinking about it days later. You know, it's got everything I want in a movie. There's no gratuitous violence, not much gratuitous violence. But apart from that, it's got, I just thought the performances were incredible. The fucking cinematography, like the reimagining, some of those sets are absolutely out of this world. Like the when they go to Lisbon, you know, I'm sure we'll get there. Yeah. But that, the imagining of Lisbon there, the mix of just the lighting and just everything about it, I was just grinning from ear to ear. I loved all the performance. I loved Willem Dafoe. I don't know your man either, the kind of guy who's the
Rami Youssef.
He starts off as,
I heard him on an interview, in an Empire interview, and I think it's essentially his feature film debut. But I think in the States, like, he writes and directs and has his own show. He's a comic, stand-up comic. I'd never really heard of him, but apparently he's, you know, big enough deal in America to get, you know, like, I think he's a Netflix special and your own show, which, I don't know, in America you can get a Netflix special. Just if you fucking order a bag of chips, you get a Netflix special with it, you know? But, he's wonderful.
Can I ask then, because I had obviously built it up. I used the word masterpiece, said how much I loved it. Were you disappointed, or were you like, okay, I agree? Or were you somewhere in the middle, or?
I really liked it, but I didn't love it. Okay. Which is, it's not disappointed. It's one of the weirdest films for me to even review when I was thinking about it. Because, and I come back to this a lot of the time, like, I absolutely adore so much of this movie, the sum of its parts, like everything from, you know, the performances, cinematography, the score, just everything. But then when, as a cohesive kind of movie going experience from a narrative point of view, I wasn't as sucked into it as I think I should have been by all those parts that I absolutely loved. And I was trying to work out what that was, because I kept thinking about what my wife said to me after she saw Oppenheimer. She listing everything she loved about it. You know, the performances, this. But there was obviously some barrier to the full experience. And I think that has something to do with, like, Ali, she's not really into time travel or non-linear narratives, stuff like that.
Okay.
Like Inception, when she saw Inception, she just kind of bounced off. It went, I had to get her to watch it a second time for her to kind of go, oh, okay, actually, you know. So I trying to figure out what was the barrier with this, because every time I think of a scene or a performance or a shot, most of the shots, I'm like you, grinning from ear to ear. It's like, it was spectacular to watch and experience a lot of this movie, but I think the barrier to it, I think it comes down to the director's kind of overindulgence on weirdness from a technical point of view, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like sometimes in certain scenes there are, you know, the scenes going on and then there'll be a strange wide shot, or numerous times there's like
a fisheye lens.
And then there's a few times there's it's a keyhole shot or a pinhole or something. There's a vignette around, and shots like that just take me out of it straight away, because I'm thinking, why? What's the purpose of that shot? It just takes me out of the scene, and then I have to struggle to get back into the scene or into the story. But if you list everything individually, from the story, performances, everything, it was wild, and I loved pretty much everything about it, but something that didn't quite connect, and I think it has to do with that. I think.
Okay, I wonder. Maybe I don't connect that because you spot some of these things as we talk about movies, obviously constantly.
Yeah.
And there's some things that you talk about, the certain shots and how they got that shot and stuff, and I'm like, geez, I wouldn't have known that at all. Mm. I think maybe it's because you would pick up on that shot or know why certain shots work and why some don't. Mm. Yeah.
Because initially I was thinking, is it because, like, I haven't really seen a lot of his movies. Is it the weird and wacky kind of nature of it? But then we think of Everything Everywhere All at Once, and that's fucking balls to the wall weird, you know?
Yeah.
But it's fucking, I think that's a masterpiece in terms of the way it's filmed. I struggle to say more conventional way in terms of it's filmed more like a movie. Or sometimes this feels like I was watching somebody make a movie, or watching a play or something from afar. I couldn't quite put my finger on it when I was watching it, but I probably need to see it again. But it's fucking mental. It's this film.
Oh, it's
batshit crazy.
Yeah. I would. I would. I'd love to see Emma Stone win the Oscar for it, just like Michelle Yeoh winning the Oscar for Everything Ever.
It's wonderful, yeah.
I'm just going to call it Everything because I'm going to keep getting it fucking wrong. But that movie, she was incredible, and I was over the fucking moon, even though Irish actors weren't winning, Kerry Condon, Colin Farrell, Brendan Gleeson weren't winning stuff. I was over the moon because I'm such a huge fan of hers. And for her to start in something so bananas and make it hers, she was excellent. And I loved every moment of Emma Stone in this. She was incredible. I really, really hope that she gets the Oscar for it.
I thought it was, like, her performance, there's just so many facets to it that are just incredible. It's like it's towering, it's fearless, it's raw, it's peerless, you know. But like she seems to anchor all the chaos around her, and she is more often than not part of that chaos. But she goes all out in this fucking movie. Like, there's just there's no vanity, there's nothing. She's just fully immersed in this mental character. And I was thinking that, like, a role like this where there's so much scope to it, you know, it's just got like Oscar bait kind of written all over it. But you'd imagine as an actor, it would terrify the shit out of you to read something like this and go, fucking hell, you know, imagine if you did get it, how the fuck are you going to do this?
Mm.
Like, regardless of all the amount of nudity and whatever, but the range that you need to portray the character at the beginning and then at the end is astonishing. And she's, yeah, I hope she wins it. I don't think I've seen too much others in that category, but I can't imagine anything else comes close to this, really. Mm. Can you?
Yeah. No. I guess maybe because there's other great performances I'd like that we should touch on. Should we just start to go through the movie on a very basic kind of level? And if anything else jumps out that either of us kind of want to talk about, we can do that.
Let's go. So then we start in London, and Emma Stone is a character. She is a lady. You see her jumping from a bridge to her death, and she is later recovered by Godwin Baxter, Willem Dafoe. Ooh, his makeup is frightening, right?
Wow,
when you really see the grooves in his chin and where it's almost like been overlapping, it's just like, fuck me, that was...
Was it Victorian London or was it... I thought it was set in Scotland. I thought it was...
Is it supposed to be? Glasgow, yeah, because the book is based in Glasgow. But that's what I thought. But when she comes back just towards the end, when those, you know, those titles come up that say, which
she does go back to London. Yeah.
That's where his house is.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah. I just, cause his accent is kind of has a Scottish twang to it. And that's why I thought, okay, it's Victorian era Scotland.
Yeah. Because I think the director said you read into as much of this as you want, but apparently some people on Twitter or whatever were pissed off because they said the location change. But he said he doesn't know really anything about Glasgow because it was really in the movie's really ingrained in Glasgow and the culture and stuff like that. And he just said, look, I'm just a Greek kind of fucking weirdo. I don't really know anything about that, but I know a bit about like Victorian London or whatever. So apparently that was a change. But even like there's a tagline or Empire's first line of Empire's Review has Scotland, Victorian Glasgow.
Okay.
So unless... Yeah. It's a bit confusing, all right.
I suppose
for the purposes of our accents, it's fucking weird.
I suppose for the purposes of us talking about it, that part's not massively important.
Yeah, so he recovers her and reanimates her as an entirely different person named Bella, and she behaves with the mentality of a small child and refers to Godwin as God. I think that was a nice play on words, actually. Godwin Baxter. She's like, God! But yeah, during one of Godwin's lectures then, just to set it up, he calls upon Max McCandless, that's Rami Youssef, to join him and become his assistant along with his maid, can't remember her name, Mrs. Prim. Mrs. Prim, yeah. And Max meets Bella and quickly becomes smitten with her despite her condition. And while working together, Godwin tells Max... after he's recovered Bella's body, he lets him in on the whole kind of secret that she was the woman who jumped off the bridge, was pregnant, and he replaced her brain with that of the baby, hence her lack of maturity.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And Bella views Godwin as something of a father figure then. And that's the setup, and you're just going, fuck me sideways. Here we go. Like,
the kind of the flashbacks and stuff as well to the contraptions that Godwin has in his house, you know, the real old style sci-fi, you know, and it almost reminds me of like a Bella Lugosi movie or something. You have down in this mad contraption.
Yeah, with the electricity and stuff.
But before you get to that, like, I think the first weird kind of thing of what the fuck is going on is he tells us that he's been experimented on by his father. That's why he has the scars and stuff.
Yeah.
But when he's sitting at the dinner table and he just goes to burp, opens his mouth and this big bubble comes out, and I just was like, that was when I knew this movie is for me. I know I'm going to love it. You can hear behind me people going, what the fuck was that?
Like, but it's played as normal and it's just like, that's just something he does. All right, that's perfectly fine.
he
alludes in at numerous points during the movie at his father, who he doesn't seem to hate or anything, but he seems to understand his father's methods and reasons for doing, you know, obviously dark and twisted experiments on him, and you know that's shown by his face and stuff when he's saying these things. You're like, oh wow! And then he just burps.
But it's I mean, like for it's the so movie subtle, itself, but the movie itself is so funny. Like, there's so many funny parts, and even him, he's talking about the how his father treated him and stuff like that.
Yeah,
as he's saying it with the deadpan face and stuff like that, like, it's fucking hilarious because the way he's delivering it, you know, when he's talking these awful things that his dad's doing, you can't help but gonna go, Jesus Christ, like, it's just it's so well done. But it's that setup alone, you're straight away going, this is some sort of Frankenstein story, basically. Mm. You know, that's what it feels like. And you're kind of kept in at the start when, as you said, he lets him in the secret. The whole idea is they're trying to... Bella is getting more and more of a person. She starts off, she can't even fully pronounce words, but as these early scenes go on...
Like 15 words a day or something.
Yeah. And she started to grow and grow and grow and stuff. And then it's almost like this caged bird. This cage isn't big enough to hold her, and she wants to go and see the outside and see the world.
Mm.
And that's kind of when... That's just around that time we get introduced to Mark Ruffalo, because what's-his-face wants to marry Bella, and he's like, well, I'll tell you what, make an agreement. You can marry her, but you have to stay here in the house.
Keep her here, yeah.
She can't go, keep her here, and then that's the agreement. And so he brings in this lawyer to bring in and ratify these papers and have an agreement that they'll all sign that this will be it. And in comes Mark Ruffalo, and I'm just so used to Mark Ruffalo recently because of Marvel movies. So... I haven't seen a performance from him that I've loved since probably Spotlight.
It's 2015.
That I've really gone, wow. Yeah, which I've gone
almost 10 years ago.
A really good performance, but he was incredible in this movie. Absolutely incredible. I love him. I thought he was fucking. It was so funny. The part when he gets so flustered, the angry stuff, the how pompous he is. You know, his delivery of his lines. Like, I couldn't get my eyes off him. I thought he was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, he's just a gloriously over-the-top buffoon, a charming buffoon.
Yeah, yeah, I thought he absolutely nailed it. But it's so
true. It's so true. Like, yeah, it's like he's just been resigned to playing, you know, pretty good Bruce Banner / Hulk and being, chastised into just this kind of cookie-cutter character. For Jesus Christ, I can't believe Spotlight is 2015. But if we get before that, like Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind, like Zodiac, he's in like Collateral. He's in these fucking fantastic movies. Really great character actor. I'm pretty sure he was nominated before or something. But again, he's got to be a front runner for an Oscar. Like in such a dark and twisted movie, as you were saying, there's so many kind of like deadpan humorous moments from Willem Dafoe and just scenery. Chewing kind of moments, but Mark Ruffalo's like some of his delivery and just the way he plays it off as if this is just how people talk or whatever. I laughed out loud about 5 or 6 times just watching him. I could watch him for fucking months and months.
Yeah.
He's just absolutely phenomenal. Phenomenal. What's one of his lines I had down here is we get to the scene later, but at the risk of being immodest, you've just been thrice fucked by the very best. That is just like a fucking straight away out of the phone. I had to write it down because my notes, like, I don't know if you were trying to take notes, like, because we do try and take notes when watching movies. But I wrote about 3 things, you know, lenses, fisheye, and just couldn't write anything else because it's just too much going on screen and you're going to miss something. Like,
I didn't take one note. Not one note. No, well, like, I wasn't sure if we were going to do this, but I was too engrossed in it. I'm fully remember the movie fine, you know, because I was so sucked into it, and it'll be one that I would watch many, many times again. So I feel I didn't even need to take any notes. You know,
stuff
popped into my head over the course of this week. I've kind of said, okay, I'll make sure to bring that up. But while I watched it, no, I didn't take any notes. I was just.
So when did you see that? Because I saw it yesterday. You saw it over the weekend.
Last weekend, whatever day. Was it last weekend? Yes, the weekend just gone. Yes, Saturday.
Super.
Yeah.
So I go with where were we? Godwin is visited by the lawyer, Mark Ruffalo, who. Takes a liking to Bella, and he offers her a chance to join him on a trip to Lisbon, even though Godwin would not allow it. But she announces her intentions to Godwin and Max, who both express, you know, their displeasure and don't want her to leave. But Godwin lets her go. And it's a nice kind of character moment for Willem Dafoe, where he really wants to keep her there, and he's telling Max, you know, the if you marry her, that's the one kind of rule, just keep her in the house. And you're thinking, right, oh, is he really this mad fucking crazy dark fucking scientist? But that kind of paternal instinct kind of showcases itself, where he wants to keep her there, but he does see, right, she does have to spread her wings and leave the nest, essentially. So so then she is whisked off to Lisbon. And what did you think of Lisbon? It's a sight to behold. The first wide of all these spots where it's, I'm thinking he's trying to go for, like, this is maybe her point of view, because it's very kind of psychedelic, steampunk-esque kind of visuals. It's almost obviously a set, but it's hyper realistic, you know, with trippy clouds it's just this fucking, that initial iconic shot of Lisbon. It does kind of take your breath away straight away with the colors. So vibrant. It's black and white up to a point. I think this is the point it cuts into color.
Yeah.
It gets Lisbon, it's like bang, there you go. It blew my mind visually.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. Like, I wanted to look at who the production company were, and he used the same production company for his movies. It's produced by an Irish company,
Elemental Pictures.
So, and they produced Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer as well. But I just had to look up that cinematography, because I was like, Jesus, this is just, it's so fucking gorgeous. Everything is cut and shot so well. It's such a feast for the eyes kind of thing. You're looking at it going, like, obviously it's not fucking Lisbon, you know what I mean? But it's just, it's this wonderful imagining of it. And it's just, and each thing is like that when they move to Greece and they go to these other places, you know, it's just this, as you said, it's almost if someone explained Lisbon to somebody and this was someone went, okay, well, I'll try and draw it from what my imagination has come up with, rather than, you know, what Lisbon actually is. I mean, they've got, overhead like monorail cars and stuff like this, which obviously weren't around in Victorian era, you know. But it's just, it's straight away, it's just that's kind of when it opened up, it became this bigger world, because at the start it's so insular. It's Bella, it's Godwin in this house, and you know, I'm wondering where this is going to go. And then when he sweeps her away, now it's like, oh shit, anything can happen now. It's opened this whole new world. Literally. But it's brilliant. And those early scenes in Lisbon, because she's just finding more and more of her voice, as you said, it's more and more, it's not just vocabulary that she's learning, it's learning about herself, learning about the world. And she's just, there's no filter on anything she says or anything does, you know? And he's him getting frustrated with her as well, you know, because he wants to have this gorgeous woman on his arm. He's so delighted to be, you know, having sex with multiple times a day.
And she won't play ball,
So it's trying to, his lack of having control over her, yet he's still absolutely besotted and bewitched by her. It's a great opening to where it leads on to.
Yeah. And at one point then, I'm not sure if this is the next scene or not, but when we go back to London and Max notices that Godwin's missing her, in her absence, and he wants to continue his research without her, and he attempts a similar experiment on another woman, I think was called Felicity.
And that's what's her face, Margaret Qualley.
That's who it is, yeah.
Yeah, I think she's great. I think she makes great choices with the stuff that she stars in, because she has all of fucking three words to say in this movie. I love the choices of the stuff that she stars in, like The Leftovers and Hair and Vice. Obviously she was in that. She was in the movie that turned out to be terrible, Death Note, but it was still great that she would have made played that character really well if she was given a decent fucking movie to star her in. And she picks a lot of little independent, smaller movies as well, like sci-fi and stuff.
She's great.
I'm a big fan of hers. Yeah, I think she'll have a really great career. Or she already has one, but I think she'll go on to do really, she's so young. They tried to do the experiment. Again, I think it's just Godwin's not only way of, it's not so much replacing her as it is a distraction, or maybe he's trying to prove to himself or go, no, it is, like, this is all she was experiment, to try and protect himself.
Play it down,
from no, she really was he really misses her. She really was a daughter to him. And this
absolutely, and you can see that in the way he treats Felicity. He really treats her as an experiment, because her intelligence is not developed as quickly as Bella's. But he's very just matter of fact and just like, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just an experiment. And, you know, lightning doesn't strike twice or whatever. And that's, that's a good point. Yeah. That it is more of a distraction, that he's trying to suppress his emotions over his experiments, you know, where, you know, really is, he's missing his daughter, which is pretty sad. But, like Duncan would get to the bit where they go on a cruise. So Duncan starts to grow exacerbated with his inability to control Bella and her rapidly developing mind and curiosity and, as you say, her no filter, which is just Emma Stone. I just don't know how Emma Stone from scene to scene, because they obviously shot this like every movie. You shoot it out of sequence, depending on locations and budgets and where you are in the script. So, but every scene, it's like she's gone from like 35%, you know, 40%, where she's just, you know, evolving ever so slightly from scene to scene. She just plays it absolutely fucking brilliantly. And that's her, like the editing in that is sublime. But Duncan,
And it's her physicality too, because as we said, like she's starting off, it's a baby's brain inside this adult. So she's barely, when she's walking around the place, she's barely lifting her feet off the ground. It's just, she's unsure at her feet. Like, so as the movie, Emma Stone plays it so well, because not only is she grown, but everything, her whole physical appearance or her way she moves changes throughout the movie, like evolves. So she's not just this wooden, fucking unsteady on her feet kind of thing. She starts to grow and grow and be more confident till towards the end. She's almost like this fucking supreme being, you know, how she plays it. As you said, it's probably shot at a sequence. So she's probably jumping from playing it this way, to going back to an older way. So it just makes it all the more impressive.
It's like pitch perfect. Like she's just captivating on screen. And as you're saying, like it's the physical performance, the physical comedy as well, that she's juggling, spinning so many plates with this performance at once in every fucking scene and out of order, knowing exactly where she is. It's just, it's almost kind of like the acting performance you'd expect of somebody far older than she, or far more mature as an actress, you know. It's like they say, you know, when an actor gets like 50s and 60s, you know, like Robert De Niro or something, they can just act in a scene without doing anything. You just do less and less, and it's like Robert De Niro in Goodfellas, you know, it's just that shot and it's just slowly just dollying in on his face, and you know exactly what he's thinking, his decisions, everything he's done with nothing. And Emma Stone is doing that in this fucking movie. She's she's just fucking wild. Duncan, he smuggles her in his large trunk onto a cruise ship as they make their way towards Alexandria. And on the ship, Bella meets some fellow passengers she starts to get into philosophy, kind of chats with them, and Duncan becomes more unhinged. I love how he just starts to become more and more, not just unhinged, he becomes almost infantile, and she's just starting to fucking lose the plot and lose all his false kind of charm, and everything is buffoonery. It just starts to spiral out of control, which is great to see. And again, that's Mark Ruffalo in a fucking nutshell. He's nailing it. But Duncan becomes unhinged, and as Bella's interests expand way beyond his own, and he attempts to attack one of Bella's two friends on the ship. He just gets so frustrated, he tries to pick her up and throw her overboard.
It's so awkward.
It's so bizarre. It's so brilliant.
Yeah. And your old yellow one plays it, because she is just bemused. She's looking at him laughing while he's pulling her deck chair across the side. And she's just like, she's just taking the piss out of him while she's doing it. You know, it's just as you said, the physical comedy, like he's so angry that she's learning, she has a book in her hand and she's not interested in talking to him, and he gets it, he throws it overboard, and your one beside him just goes like that and just hands her another book instead. So she just starts reading that instead. You see it losing the plot. That goes overboard as well. And it's that whole duality of it. Like, he's so angry and pissed off that he can't control her, but at the same time, he is infatuated and obsessed with her. You know, so it's not like, right, I'm sick of this fucking woman. She's doing my head in. Mm. I'm gone the minute I get off. But he can't get away from her because he's so just enamored, so obsessed.
Obsessed. Yeah. Where he starts with, she like, you're lucky to have me, you know, la la la, to I'm besotted with you, like, and I can't live without you. Like.
I think it's a good point when you mentioned the two people that she met on the boat. This is where she kind of has that shit. Like, at the moment, it's everything is me. The new experiences, I want to experience this, the bigger world. When she first starts, like, learning to masturbate and pleasure herself, and it's all about, she wants sex all day, every day. Yeah. As you said, furious jumping. You know, it's just obsessed with just physical pleasure, with the drinking, with food. Everything is all pleasure. And then when the boat goes to Greece, it is Greece, isn't it? Yeah. And that's where you see this massive humanity and this care for mothers come in. When she looks down and she sees the poverty outside the city, the people who are babies who are dying and sickness and everything else. And that absolute breakdown that she has on the stairs when she's going down to it's just, that's when she realizes the others in the world and the pain that's in the world and the unfairness and all that kind of stuff. And still her innocence persists because we see what's his face, Mark Ruffalo, is after, exasperated with her, he goes and spends all his money in the casino and he's hammer drunk and he's playing away and he wins a ton of money, passes out in his room with all the money he's ever made, passed out, and she takes it up and decides she's going to give it to the poor. But again, it shows her innocence is still there because she brings it down and she's like, oh, I need to get off. And the lads are like, no, the boat's leaving, we can't. And she goes, but I have this box of money that I have to give to the poor because they need it. And they're like, well, why don't you give it to us? I mean, we're staying on. We'll make sure it definitely gets there. And she's like, oh, okay. And just hands it over fucking massive wad of cash. And she just completely assumes. All the money
he ever had. Like,
and completely assumes the best of them, that why would they possibly be lying? And doesn't understand why. And she said, Mark Ruffalo has an absolute freak out when he finds out, you know, it's fucking brilliant when he finds out what she's done with the money, because he's already losing it with the ship's captain because he's convinced someone has broken into his room and robbed his money, when really it's Bella when he just passed out from. It's so good.
Obviously they have no money, so they get chucked off in Marseille. But the pair then end up in Paris, where Bella comes across a brothel, and they obviously have no money, and she seeks employment with Madame Swiney, who's I can't remember the actress's name, but she's fucking fantastic, like absolutely fantastic. She starts working there, and Duncan becomes disgusted by Bella fornicating with multiple men, and becomes pissed when he learns she had emergency funds all along that Godwin had sewn into her her jacket or something. So he just loses the fucking plot again. Bella befriends a fellow prostitute named Toinette. Is that her name? Remember who she was?
No, actually.
I know her from somewhere.
French, yeah.
She's absolutely
stunning. Stunning. I'm not sure what else I know her from. She's gorgeous.
So she kind of introduces her to the world of like socialism and engages in sexual activity with her as well. And this is all, it's like Emma Stone taking power of her sexuality, because we had witnessed obviously her kind of sexual awakening as part of her development and pleasuring herself, and then just having furious jumping for hours and hours a day. But then to actually realize, hold on, I can make money by doing this. And I love that it's not, there's no negative connotations to this at all in that script or in the movie whatsoever. It's just like, well, that's what you'll do. And it's all comes from Mark Ruffalo's point of view, where he's fucking like, how dare you? Like, what, you know, and absolutely loses his fucking mind. But Duncan eventually has a breakdown and gets institutionalized. Mm. He writes to Godwin, who is falling heavily ill. And he sends Max to visit Duncan, who tells him what Bella has been up to. And then Bella is brought back to visit her dying father in the estate. And this is where we see it's the estate in London. So it must be.
I love the cards, you know, the cards, the setups in between each city where they were going.
They're so inventive.
They're beautiful. Oh yeah. They're just absolutely gorgeous. They're just so ethereal or something about it. And it's just excellent. But back to London, and it was actually so nice to, I mean, it's great. As I said, I loved the fact that they're out exploring the world and stuff, and I loved on the ship.
You're beautiful, hoping that she goes back, like, aren't you?
Yeah. There was something so nice, but he's like, oh, great. I'm glad that he's not going to pass while she's not there. I wanted to see the two of them reunited, and it's her then going back and finding out the truth, finding out, because she doesn't realize that she was a baby put inside a fucking body of a woman who had killed herself. You know, so her going back and fucking finding that out and having to confront Godwin about it as well.
Mm. And just kind of deal with it. And then she decides to go ahead with the with getting married to Max. And as he especially doesn't care about her sexual exploits, and she's happy about that. But however, just as the ceremony, and this caught me completely off guard. I thought the movie was wrapping up, you know. As the ceremony is getting underway, it's interrupted by some General Alfie or something, who calls Bella as his wife Victoria. And there was something that prefaced this earlier on when they were on the cruise, where someone came up to Bella and then called her and said, oh, hello, Victoria something, and Bella was like, I don't know who you're talking about. So
yeah,
this is revisited here, where he says he's come to reclaim her because he's her husband and take her back home. And then Bella learns.
What's great about that is when he comes in is that, you know, he has this thing. Is this one of these weddings where someone can interrupt and, you know?
And
I said, but Mark Ruffalo was there with him, because Mark Ruffalo is the one who told him.
Oh,
remember his name. He said, but it's just this real, if I can't have you, I'd rather this fucking dickhead have you than, you know, if I can't, I'd rather so dickhead petulant. than you get to live. Happily ever after, you get to have your wedding. I would rather this piece of shit, this ex, this husband who, you know, obviously your woman had killed herself, you know, and stuff like this. This is the reason that she ran away or whatever was because of this guy. It's like, I would rather see you with this piece of shit, even if it's not with me, rather than see you happy. It's just so petulant. And he just becomes this small, small, small little man, you know. But yeah, I still loved it because he's in the background almost like, you know, my mate holding me back, you know, he's pointing over his shoulder.
Yeah, yeah. He's delighted with himself. Like, look what I've done.
Yeah.
What did you make of their scene then when she decides to go with General Alfie back to their estate? And this is fucking, this just went really, really dark.
Yeah, it gets super dark. But that's set. There's a wide scene when both of them are sitting on either end of that long table. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you find out that the general, this guy that she was betrothed to before, or her husband, or whatever it was an absolute piece of shit. His staff hated him. He carried a gun around at all times because he was afraid his staff were going to kill him. You know, he was just an absolute monster. And he's obviously treated her like shit, the woman who died, Bella's mother. But that scene, it's gorgeous. That set for wherever they shot, whatever fucking castle. I don't know if it's a set or if it's actually inside a real castle or whatever, but it's fucking gorgeously ornate and everything.
It gets
super dark. He pretty much tells her that he plans on keeping her there, you know, that's it, you're going to essentially be my prisoner. He plays that part so well. I only know him from one other thing. You wouldn't see the movie called Possessor?
No,
it's kind of it's kind of a horror-y sci-fi. It's not very scary, but it's really well done. It's God, I'm never going to remember her name, so I'm not even going to try. But it's Jennifer Jason Leigh and Angela Riseborough.
Okay.
And it's a whole thing of these people go in and you can link into someone else's brain and control them, kind of thing. This is a job certain undercover people have. It's really cool, but he's taken over by her in one part to do a hit basically on someone. But that's the only other thing I've seen him in. Well, I quite enjoyed him in this. He was so menacing.
Oh, he's a despicable human being. It's always a good sign of a good villain when you're just, Jesus Christ, if you saw the actor in the street, you'd want to thump him in the fucking face. Like, it's pretty shocking that he plans to keep her there, and how cruel he is to the staff, you know, because even when Bella gets there and she's walking to her room, with one of the maids, and she's kind of going, you know, asking her what her name is or something. She's just getting cold, like empty nothing from this woman. She's just like, wondering why she isn't engaging in conversation with her. And you find out that the two of them just treated the staff with like fucking pigs and, you know, pointing guns at them and just, oh my God. It was quite shocking. And then like Bella eventually escapes by Alfie's aiming a gun at her and she turns it on him, or they have a little struggle and shoots him in the foot. And she returns to Godwin and there's a lovely scene where it's herself and her father, and then Max joins the shot as well, where the three of them are just kind of just lying with Godwin as he passes away. That's very, very touching. It's just, there's a few moments where you're hoping that she does get back to him, just to have a little last moment with her eccentric father. And do you want to describe the mad final scene, which was just gloriously heartwarming, touching, and just couldn't stop laughing.
Well, I was so happy that it got a happy ending, because there's some movies I don't care if it gets a happy ending, as long as the ending is satisfying. Sometimes the bad ending is satisfying. Sometimes the ending where you don't get to know what happens is satisfying. It's the one where, okay, well, I'm happy to work it out for myself, or I'm happy to have my imagination to where this ends up going. You know, I don't need it all wrapped up in the bow. But for this, I kind of wanted a happy ending, and it was just the most bizarrely happy ending ever. Like, she gets when she comes back to Godwin, I think the servants from the house help her bring Alfie the dickhead back to Godwin's thing. And she ends up running the same experiment with the brain swap, except she puts a goat's brain inside Alfie's head instead. And we should say, at the start of the movie, you see all these other experiments running around the house, like these things, like he has, like, you know, like a dog's head on a chicken or whatever, because that's what he does.
Pig on a chicken, it's fucking great.
So to see them then, and they're in the garden and they're sitting out, and Margaret Qualley's character is with the maid and they're playing catch ball, and she manages to catch it for the first time. The maid is happy. She's going to have a drink with them. They're sitting out in the garden to have cocktails, and Alfie's just around on his fucking hands and knees, bleeding like the fucking goat that he is. It was so fucking funny. I did. Part of me wondered why, if she knew how to do it, why didn't she take Godwin's brain and put it into a healthy body? That thing. Or there is a line he says he says something about, I can operate. And he says something, but there's no point because the cancer is spread. It's not just where it is now. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's not only has he got a plate in his head, but it's the cancer is spread to his brain or something like that. And that's why you can't. But I just wondered there for a second. I wonder why she didn't do that. I assume she would have, could she? But I thought it's better that they didn't. You know, I think it's nice that there was,
that would have been a
beautiful
bit
goodbye.
Too saccharine, you know, just
It was a beautiful goodbye.
Would take something away from the death, then, and, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but it was a beautiful boy. He knew that she not only accepted him as her father, he accepted her as a daughter. She forgave him for the lies and everything that what he had done. It was just, he died at peace and left her. She said she wanted to be a surgeon. He left her his surgery. And I was beaming at that ending. Absolutely. Smile on my face. I loved it. What
about
you?
Nice. Yeah. When he realizes that she's forgives him. You know, because he's this tortured kind of character that, you know, that we, it's almost like the, you know, childhood haunts manifest themselves in him. You know, it's almost like, you know, we are our parents, where he's doing the mad shit that his father is doing. And that's kind of a frightening thought, but it's just, it's a nice send off. And I still, even at the last shot, still just, because it's, nice close up on him, just still marveling at his prosthetics. I really can't wait to see behind the scenes on this and just see how long did he have to sit in a chair for that, because they're teetering on the edge of being a caricature or being, you know, it just, they're accentuating his jaw and But yeah, just the it's just grotesque. But yeah, a lovely ending, a really nice nice touching moment just to proceed the madness with the guy with the goat's brain, which is exactly what he fucking deserved. It was fantastic ending to it. But So yeah, what are you, like, closing thoughts? You just absolutely
I'm absolutely in love with it. I really hope that I still think in the last year, maybe even 2 years, I still think Oppenheimer is the best movie I've seen. So I hope that that wins Best Picture.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be disappointed if this did, but I would 100% want to see. I know Willem Dafoe didn't get nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
It's a shame.
I didn't check the rest of them. I know, obviously, Emma Stone got nominated. I don't know. I think Mark Ruffalo got nominated.
Did he not? Fuck. Because I know it's got, I think I got 11, it's got some, like, 11 nominations, boys? Which is 11. Okay. Yeah, it's only 11 or 12. It's just one or two shy of the record, which is like Titanic and Lord of the Rings. Think of 13 each or 14 each. But it's crazy. Getting double digits is phenomenal because the movie's batshit fucking crazy. Like, absolutely batshit crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd love to... It makes me want to see his other movies because, I haven't seen any of them. And it's kind of strange for the trajectory that he's on, that he's so still... true to his eccentricities in terms of filmmaking, storylines, and the things he's making and pursuing. But
wonderful that no one's trying to rein him in as well.
Exactly, you know what
I mean?
Yeah.
And I think there's no one trying to rein him in.
And his kind of connection with Element Pictures is the fuel for that, I think, because they've just let him do what you want to do, and I think they've supported him the whole way. This is the fourth collaboration with them, I think. But the fact that his trajectory has been so, it should be growing and growing and growing, obviously with The Favourite and a few Oscar nominations as well. The fact that, as you said, it's still, he hasn't been like, oh, just maybe just, you don't want to do that. That's a bit weird. Or, you know, do you really want to do that movie? It's a bit fucking batshit crazy. And he's like, no, give me, what, they give him 35, 40 million or something for it. And just like, go nuts. You know what I mean? And he's got he can pick and choose pretty much whoever he wants for his next movie. Like, everyone will be, fuck yeah. And if you want to challenge yourself from a performance point of view, you're not getting a straight cookie cutter standard character arc or whatever. You're getting a chance to just go absolutely fucking nuts. I didn't touch on the score, actually, which is a crazy off-kilter fucking tone. Like, Jerskin Fendrix, that's what his name is. His score is baffling. Like, it's baffling. It's bonkers. It comes in at times when there's a scene, you know, playing out, and you would expect a certain type of music to come in to accompany this maybe emotional scene or something like that, and then bells and fucking horns come in, and it just makes perfect sense with the fucking madness that is the movie. Like,
yeah, it's almost music that you'd expect to go along with, like, a comedy scene or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like, and then almost like, am I supposed to find this very funny? Or, like, it's good.
Yeah, the cinematography actually shout out to it. It's Robbie Ryan. It's an Irish cinematographer who's, it's glorious. And you can see from even the trailer alone, but there's so many shots in this where, like we've said about a few movies, in her movie review, where you could take any frame and just blow it up and it's stick it on your wall and fucking have you thinking for days. But he's brilliant. Batshit crazy.
So I assume we'd both recommend it, but let's say if you had to give it a star rating out of five, we can do half stars as well, don't forget. What would you give it?
I'd say four. I'd have to give it four.
Yeah. I go four and a half. I don't think any movie is perfect. I'm not sure if I'd ever give a movie a five stars, because five stars is literally perfect. I don't know if anything deserves a five star unless it's my favorite movie, Jaws. I don't know if we can give a movie, but this is as close to, you know, this is as close to perfect for me, for my type of movie that I want. I love a bonkers movie. I love a feast for the eyes. Love the performances. You know, and especially it really, what I'm really happy about is how it made me absolutely in love with fucking Mark Ruffalo again. I just thought he was brilliant. He was absolutely excellent. I think for, I just feel, I know this is a terrible thing to say, almost a little bit of a dialing it in with the Marvel stuff. Like there's a part where they have him CG'd into the Hulkbuster thing and he's like, oh, you guys are really fucked now or something. It's just real.
Did you film that at home?
Like it just didn't, there's nothing. Yeah. It's a lot of times he's not even acting the part. Like you see him in She-Hulk or whatever else. And it's the Hulk. He's as the Hulk. It's not him, you know, whereas this is just something completely different. And
it must have been such a breath of fresh air for him. Really, it must have been to get your teeth into this. He'd just go, yes, fucking please sign me up. Like, I want to show the world what I can do.
People must have had an absolute blast working with him as well. I would to be seeing that performance the whole time. He must have been a blast to watch perform as well. So I'd go 4.5. You go 4. I think that's very high praise for
absolutely.
It.
It's a very, very, very good watch. Excellent performances and just bonkers. Just everything about it is bonkers. An exciting director to watch.
Go and see it.
On that note, we'll wrap up the movie review and on to Phil now. We didn't actually say what we were going to do this week, but on to Phil, our retro corner, who's going to surprise us with some Nintendo stuff.
Yeah. Cheers, Daz. Yeah, I decided this will be a fairly compact retro corner. So this year is the 20th anniversary, and that's why I thought I'd do it, because it's the 20th anniversary of the Nintendo DS. So I thought it'd be fun to switch it up and do like a tech review. I know we've done some in the past, but to do it for our retro corner, to go back and revisit this. Like it was 2004 for the States and for Japan, but we didn't get it until the following year, which is mad because we ended up getting it like in 2005, and then the DS Lite was released in 2006.
Wow, was it that quick?
Yeah, it was so quick.
That's mad.
But yeah, I just figured that, like, as I said, I won't drone on for too long, but I figured as it was such a successful console that it kind of warrants a bit of love on what is his birthday year, you know? Did you have a DS yourself?
No, not at all. This was around the start of, remember, I think I mentioned before that, like, from being Nintendo nut to, like, when, I think 2003, 2004, when I kind of went traveling and just... make it mad in retrospect to think that, like, when I went traveling, I stopped playing Nintendo consoles, when getting a DS fucking handheld console is the perfect thing to have.
So
I didn't have any of the DSs. I think I tried one of yours back in around the time of Rock Band and stuff. You showed me some ninja game on one of yours, and I was like, this is fucking cool. And that's the only time I touched one, I think, ever. Which is mad,
but what's mad about this one is that, like, everybody seemed to have one. I mean, this was one where, like, my ma had one. People's parents had them because there was a lot of easily accessible games. You know, that brain came with the DS Lite game and the brain trainer game. Yeah, and people love that. You know, people still do mess around with things like that. And so, like I said, everybody had one, and I think that's what made it. Like, it still is the second best selling console of all time. After the PlayStation 2. So 154.02 million units sold.
Fuck's sake.
That's
insane.
It's different iterations. Yeah, because there was the DS, DS Lite, there was the DSi and the DSi XL. I mean, mostly had the same power, but, you know, it's the same console, just a different thing. But it's the first one that came out was pretty ugly. You know, I don't remember if you remember, but it was a little more chunky than what the DS Lite was. So it came out, and even the first time looking at it, I think I had a silver one. And I was like, yeah, like it's great that it's what the piece of tech is.
It just didn't
look fantastic. But once you opened it up, you got what the DS, what it's named for, is the dual screen. So you've got one screen on top, one screen on the bottom, and the one on the bottom had a touch sensor on it and a little microphone and stuff. And so the games would get you involved in doing that, because so many of the games were first party Nintendo stuff and they were made specifically for the DS rather than being multiple consoles like we see now. So they were all using that software, using that hardware, you know, for their games. So like you'd have some games like Zelda or things like that where you had like a pinwheel that needs to be blown. And so you're literally blowing at the console kind of thing, you know, things like that. But it was the the DS Lite really was where it kind of came into its own, because that 154 million, 98 million of that was a DS Lite. Wow. It was this just, it was so much slicker. It was gorgeous looking machine. It still looks cool. But what I loved about the not only having the dual screens, which obviously worked in tandem, was that it had wireless capability, not just to say have Nintendo Wi-Fi internet, but it had like short range wireless connectivity between your mates. And so like, I remember playing it on a plane when we were going away to South America, and we were sitting in different parts of the plane playing Mario Kart against each other, you know, on this thing, you know, and like, it was class. And like, it was backwards compatible for Game Boy Advance games. You could play ROMs on it, you know, and download them for free, which obviously I would never do anything as illegal as
Jesus,
that. And this podcast, we don't recommend.
We don't support any piracy of any kind.
Yeah, not at all. And, anyway, yeah, that was fucking deadly. You can play ROMs. So like, so being able to get any game you could think of. And the launch price wasn't even that bad when you consider by today's standards, because of what it was. Like, we'd been playing on handheld consoles up to now, on whether it was a, you know, portrait style one or a, like a Game Boy Color, or like your, over the years, you had Atari Lynx and your Sega Mega Drive, Sega Game Gear, and that was kind of a rectangle kind of shape. Whereas this was the first one to have a flip up, two screens on the rest of it, that they could have charged for the nose, because it was such a step up graphically as well. But the release price was €150, which is
$225.
Yeah, I think it's 225 or 226 when I looked it up today. You think about the price of a console that comes out now.
$400 or $500, easy.
Yeah, like it was totally reasonable.
Hence the 98 million fucking. Yeah.
Most of it, like, and the DS Lite, I don't think the original DS, but the DS Lite came with a stylus as well, which is great. But I think most of the launch games for it were pretty average. Like, it was a decent console, but the games for the first couple of years weren't exactly fantastic, especially not in Japan and America, because it was released there with very few games. Now, because we didn't get it until the end of almost 2005, the more games had been out at that point. And then by the time, I think I didn't get one till I got to get my DS. I think I didn't play it for a while. I got the DS Lite in 2006. At that stage, there's a bunch of cool shit out then at that stage, you know. So we've got this cool little compact, slick-looking fucking thing. It was advertised so well that it sold out fucking everywhere multiple times. It was out of stock. The same thing that happens with all Nintendo consoles. Happened with the 3DS, happened tons of times with the Switch. You remember the Switch at the start?
Just couldn't
fucking
get it anywhere.
Goldust, you know. Couldn't get them anywhere. Parents going mad for Christmas not being able to get one. Because it had been out for a couple of years then, we started to get more and more good games. So like Mario 64 came out on it. We had Metroid Prime Hunter. I still think the best game I played on it though was definitely Mario Kart DS. Like, you can play some of those courses now on Mario Kart 8 on the Switch.
Yeah.
But it was just class. The music was great. It looked the business. Like, it was, you'd have on the you're playing on the top screen, you'd see your character and everything around, but then the bottom screen, you look down, it has the track and show you where you were and stuff, you know.
That's cool.
So it obviously then, you know, it did quite well. I think it was right up until, it must have been 2012 or 13 or something. Like, it was around for years before we got the 3DS, which also did incredibly well and used tons of the same elements, but it was out for quite a while. And I suppose that longevity probably is what, allowed for it to have such good, good sales for so long, because it was the only thing like that on the market. You know, the Vita and the PSP and stuff, they were fun, but they were never going to get the accessibility that a Nintendo console has, you know. And it's, for me, Nintendo are still the kings of portable gaming. I know you've got the Steam Deck, and there's Lenovo do their own one as well, the Legion, but they're still the kings of it, you know.
Well,
I just said before I kind of finish up on it, because that's kind of a brief synopsis of the game, I thought I'd run through just some of the great games that I loved on it. So if you are out there and you do happen to have access to the Steam Deck, and you can get access to these things, legally or illegally or whatever.
You're looking at them.
Some of these games are absolute gems. So there's GTA Chinatown Wars, great little Chinatown game or GTA game. Love the little mini games that even involved the touchscreen. Like you'd have to hotwire a car, and the touchscreen would bring up the little wires.
Oh, that's cool. Screen.
You'd have to go and twist them together, kind of thing. And the Mario Kart one, obviously, I mentioned there was two Mario and Luigi games that were both great. The new Super Mario Brothers, one of my all-time favorite Zelda games was on it, the Phantom Hourglass.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Incredible game. Yeah, that was one of two. And there was the other one was Spirit Tracks, which was good as well, but not as good as that.
What was on the extra screen for the Zelda games?
Like your inventory and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, then you have inventory, because you're the usual thing, you're going around to pick up bits and pieces and stuff. And again, you'd use it to interact with certain parts of the game as well, you know. But I remember, I can't remember which one of those two games it was, but because you could mark the screen was great for being on the map and going, I need to know to get back to X, Y, and Z, you know, mark a door that I need to go back to when you get your stylus out and mark it and stuff. Then there was Castlevania, Dawn of Sorrows, the first Animal Crossing, Chrono Trigger. The Professor Layton games were great. That was real. It was real RPG, like a puzzle RPG, almost like an adventure puzzle RPG style games. Really clever, really cool little cutscenes that were actually voiced and everything. So they were good fun. Then Metroid Prime Hunters, as I said, Super Mario 64. The Pokemon games were actually pretty good. There's tons of games, but they're the ones I would most likely revisit if I got my hands on one again. Anyway, like I said, it was going to be a very brief revisit. I just wanted to do it because it's the anniversary of the console. And it's fun to go back and I think.
Oh, absolutely.
It was fun for me. Yeah, it was fun for me to go back and just kind of, I had a list of games that I was like, I remember playing X, Y, and Z. I must have a full list as I was going through. I was like, oh, Jesus, yeah, I love that one. I love that one too. Like, so it was a nice little trip down memory lane to kind of go back through and
it's nice. It gives me a list of some other games to add to my growing list of games.
That you won't play.
next week I'll add 15 DS games to it. No, but it's good to because I never even entertained the thought of being able to revisit some of these games, because obviously they can't really pick up a DS, or I'm not going to pick up. I think you can get them cheap enough in CEX and stuff, but yeah, there are other means that you can get them and play them. So yeah, I might check out a few of them.
Nice.
That's nice. Nice trip down.
Well, look, that's it for the Retro Corner. Before we finish up, I would like to talk about something exciting, which is what me and Daz have coming up now. Daz mentioned last time out, he mentioned the year 1999 and was saying how it was such an incredible year for movies, but also for video games as well. And because it's 25 years on now, what we thought we'd do is a Party Like It's 1999 series. So for the next 4 weeks... So the whole month of February, basically, what we're going to do is our movie is going to be back to a movie from that year that came out. And then as well, for the Retro Corner, we'll pick a game as well from 1999 as well. So maybe we'll have a bit of crack with it as well. You know, feel free to get involved. Let us know what your favorite movies were for that. What songs from 1999 bring you back to that year as well. You know, like... Were you shitting yourself for Y2K? You know, what was going through your mind in the year of 1999?
It's all going to end.
Well, it was turning the millennium. It was massive. You know, like, it was supposed to be this fucking huge thing. And, yeah, nothing fucking happened. Yeah. But it was a fantastic year for movies. A real, you'll see as we talk about them. And we'll be doing some others throughout the year, kind of around their anniversary. But for the month of February, we're going to have, a Party Like It's 1999.
Some bangers.
Also fun because, some bangers. And because they're all older, you know, you'll feel free to listen along without having it fucking spoiled for you. But you can be reliving it along with us. Well, I'm really looking forward to that, to getting into that over the next 4 weeks. To look at movies that old, and because we're going to be an absolute bangers, it's always fun to have ones to take the piss out of. But when you're going back to these ones and transporting you back to the year 99, or remembering actors that maybe aren't around with us anymore or don't act anymore or what else was going on that year. I think those episodes are going to be a lot of fun.
100%. What a fucking year. I can't wait to dive into some of this stuff. Happy days.
Deadly. Well, look, if there's nothing else from your end, Daz, anything else you want to finish up with?
No, just keep, thanks for all the support. Keep the emails coming at middleagedgeeks@yahoo.com. And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, keep getting in contact, and also do us the usual favor of liking and subscribing and sharing and telling your mates. That'd be fantastic for us. So thanks a million for listening, and we will see you next week where we travel back in time. All right. Make it easy, guys.
Thank you very much. See you later.
Good luck. Bye-bye.